Okay, so hello and welcome for our computer graphics lecture. And today we will speak about another important part of the rendering pipeline, and these are transformations. So when doing rendering, we, as you will see today and in the next lectures, we will do a lots of geometric transformations on points. So we will interpret points in different coordinate systems, and it's a long way from a point that is defined somewhere in a local coordinate system up to the moment that it's on the screen and directly has a pixel address. And the different phases, the different steps of this pipeline, we will speak about later on. Today we will speak about the theory of these transformations and how we can describe these transformations in a nice and elegant way that is not really redundant but supports everything that we will need during or within our rendering pipeline. And so we will start with a simple rather simple class, subclass of transformations. These are affine transformations. We will see what different steps we can describe by these. We will then have a look at homogeneous coordinates. Some of you probably already saw these. And we'll then go to a more interesting class of transformations. These are projective transformations. These will be required to also represent perspective. Yeah, which is, as you will see, not that simple. And since they are a very important subpart, and there are many different ways to describe them, we will have a closer look in particular on rotations. Okay, but first of all, let me give you a little introduction about the different phases where we will need transformations and what types of transformations will be applied there. So in our rendering pipeline, we first of all have these steps that describe what we will call the modeling transformation. The idea of the modeling transformation is the following. We have a world coordinate system that we can define somehow. So we say, okay, now this is our origin, here my hand. This is the x, this is the y, and this is, no, this is x, this is y, and this is the z axis. So that's my world. And now I have a number of different objects in that world. So I have this desk here, this chair, the many different chairs of this auditorium here. And these are usually modeled in their own coordinate system. So this table is modeled on its own. So it has its own coordinate system, for instance, an origin here in the center of the table, and its own x, y, and z axis. And now, first of all, we have to position that table in our global world. That's positioning objects in a scene, and that's a geometric transformation. Furthermore, we could change the shape of objects. So one particular case is that maybe this table here is modeled in centimeters, and my world is modeled in inches, and then I have to somehow transform these. That's not really changing the shape, it's a scaling, but there would also be other possibilities. Maybe I want to have another table that is just higher but not wider, so I only want to scale it in that direction and stuff like that. So I can do simple modifications on these objects, or I could create multiple copies of objects. So for instance, these tables, you're sitting on, the seats you're sitting on, they are not unique. They are the same. There are, I think, 112 of these seats in this room here, and ideally you only have one description of the geometry of one of these seats, and then you position these objects at multiple places in the scene. All this together is what we describe the modeling as the modeling transformation. Transform objects which are typically modeled in their own coordinate system in the global world. But then There's also another transformation, and this describes my virtual camera. So when I have this world now to generate an image, I must say, okay, now I position my camera or my virtual camera or my eye or my virtual eye or whatever you want to call it. I position it here, and I look into this direction. Yeah, and we handle this in computer graphics in a way that we transform all coordinates now to a coordinate system which is local to the camera. Yeah, we transform all coordinates such that the virtual camera is in the origin and the viewing direction is the set direction, for instance, and such that the y direction always shows upwards. Yeah? So that's again a geometric transformation, and that transformation defines our camera position, view direction, and stuff like that. Yeah, and this is what we call the viewing transformation. Okay, and later on, we will also have. So these two types of transformations are affine transformations. Yeah, so they belong to this class we will speak about in the beginning, and then there will be another transformation. So that's only the affine ones. Where we add perspective, yeah, and this will not be an affine transformation. For this, we have to look at a wider class, and probably more interesting class. These are the projective transformations. Okay, so before we close a look at this, let me start with an I think interesting difference that we could keep in mind, but I will not always insist on it in the following, and that's that it makes perfect sense to differentiate between points and vectors. A point, what we describe as a point, is just a position in space. Yeah. So this is a point in space, this is a point in space, and this is a point in space. Yeah. This is what we typically describe with a three-tuple, so with an x, y, and z coordinate. Yeah? Such a space typically has no algebraic structure. That means we cannot add two points. Yeah? It doesn't make sense to say, I want to add this point to this point. Yeah? We will see later on that of course, we can do computations. But to be able to do computations, we also need vectors. And often these points and vectors are mixed up, but it makes sense to differentiate these. A vector is a difference between two points. Yeah? So if I have this point and this point, the vector, these points define the vector from here to here. Yeah? That's a vector. And so a vector is just the difference between two points. And with vectors, now we can do the computations that we are used to. We can add two vectors, yeah, and we can multiply a vector with a scalar, and we can generate linear combinations, etc. Yeah, so vectors are typically the quantities we do computations on. Okay, and now I'm introducing that here because using this difference or this notion of points and vectors spans what is typically called an affine space. And the idea here is the following, that we say if we have two points, A and B, yeah, these are just two points, these two define a vector, which we call AB, which is just the vector from A to B. And we will describe this as just the difference between B and A. Yeah? So AB is the vector B minus A. So in the following, we will always write B minus A. And so vector point minus point is a vector. Then there are further things we can do. For instance, we can add a vector to a point. This gives us another point. Or we can add vectors, and this gives us a new vector. Yeah. Okay, so often these two spaces are mixed and are not differentiated, so mostly they are not, but nevertheless it makes perfect sense. And so what is typically the interpretation would be that we say a point is considered to be the vector from the origin of our world to this point. If we interpret this as a vector, from then on we only have vector computations, and we can, yeah, just continue with that. Later on, when we are working with homogeneous coordinates, for instance, we will come back and see again how this difference comes in and that it makes perfect sense to differentiate that. And some libraries for vector calculations, for instance, also consider that difference. So they have a different type, a different class for points and for vectors. Yeah? And they really take care that you cannot say for a particular point, for instance, or that they do not support the addition of two points. Yeah? Because in that setup, it doesn't make sense. Yeah? Okay. Maybe not not that important in the very beginning. One more thing on this is that what is interesting to notice nevertheless is that we have this. Okay, let's make two things. So the first of all, let's say you have two points, P and Q. And now when I said it doesn't make sense to add these two points, you might say, okay, but how can I, for instance, compute the midpoint between them? Yeah, if I want to compute the midpoint, what I compute is P plus Q half. Yeah? That would be the midpoint. And that's a valid computation you want to do on two points. You want to have the point just in between. Or maybe you want to have all the points on this line between P and Q. And okay, so my argument now is that you can just rewrite this. So this is from a strict view of type checking. Yeah, this is not allowed. But what would be allowed is to say P plus Q minus P half. Yeah? So we take the vector from P to Q. We scale that by 1/2. So this gives us this vector. And this vector we add to P. Yeah? So doing the typical arithmetic you are used with fractions, this is the same, but from a type checking point of view, it's not. Yeah? And so because this is quite complicated to write, there's a way that kind of allows us these operations, this kind of operations, and that's the affine combination. And the idea is the following. We say what is allowed on points is that we add multiple points, and all these points are weighted with weights lambda I. And this operation is allowed if all the weights add up to 1. So that's a bit weird, maybe, at first sight. But essentially, it is exactly this. So what we compute here is 1/2 times P plus 1/2 times Q. Yeah? This is exactly such an operation. So this would be lambda 1, and this would be lambda 2, and they add up to 1. Yeah? And such types of linear combinations of points, yeah, they are allowed. And this is the more general way to describe that. And it is not only allowed for two points, but also for multiple points. So for instance, you should have learned also about barycentric coordinates, for instance. So if we have, if we have a triangle ABC, yeah, we can describe any point within the triangle using such a linear combination. Alpha, beta, and gamma are scalars, and they are barycentric coordinates if they add up to 1. Yeah? And yeah, this simply describes all points on the plane spanned by A, B, and C. Yeah, so this is allowed, and this is called an affine combination. Yeah, and okay, we will, yeah. And the same can be done for the difference. And yeah, this is probably not that important. It's just a generalization of the idea that if we take two vectors, two points, and subtract and generate the difference, yeah, we get a vector, and we can generalize this by saying, okay, this B minus A also is a linear combination. The weight for A is minus one, and this for B is one. And it's the generalization of this is that we, if we build a linear combination where the weights add to one, to zero, sorry, then this is a generalized difference. Okay, good, yeah? So if you, so it makes perfect sense, yeah, to allow this way, this affine combination on points, so that's an operation on points, and that's another that generates new points or a new point from many input points, and this is an operation that generates a vector from multiple points. Yeah, it's the generalization of the difference, and this barycentric interpolation here. Okay, good. Yeah, and we could, so some of you maybe visit the lecture on geometric modeling. There these things will be carried much further, and it can be shown that using these affine combinations, for instance, is the basic to define wonderful curves and stuff like that, yeah? And this can be carried much further then. Okay, but now for our setup, the situation can be also described rather intuitively. Yeah. Our typical image to interpret affine transformations will be that we use multiple coordinate frames. Yeah. So we have a coordinate frame in 2D is defined by an origin and two vectors. Yeah. So a coordinate frame can be positioned somewhere in space. We just say, okay, this is my new origin, and these are vectors that define my new coordinate axis. Okay, and the standard coordinate frame is just the origin and these are the two standard axes, of course. Okay, and now I can do an affine transformation simply by taking coordinates or by taking such an object and interpreting the coordinates within that new coordinate frame. Yeah. So every point here has an x and y coordinate, and if we apply this to this new coordinate frame, we get this new shape here. Yeah? And this is a transformation of this shape. Yeah? And the transformation from here to here now is an affine transformation. And yeah, we can describe this in this way. So we have a point at position x, y, and transforming it to that new coordinate frame means taking the origin plus x times this axis plus y times this axis. Yeah, and this transforms this shape to this shape. And if we write this down a bit differently and use matrix notation, we will end up with something like this. So xy is transformed. So these are vectors, yeah, e1 and e2. This vector, this defines a matrix. We take this matrix times xy plus our origin. And if we take that more generally, we can say this transformation looks like that. X is multiplied by a matrix, A, and then an offset is added. Yeah? So an affine transformation just means multiply the point with a matrix and apply an offset. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's affine. And the other way around, that means if we have the matrix, if we look at the columns of this matrix, we see the transformed unit vectors. Yeah, so we will see later on how this will help us. Yeah, so if we have that matrix, we can immediately draw this corresponding coordinate frame. Or the other way around, if we have that coordinate frame, we can immediately generate this matrix. Okay, so such affine mappings are quite simple to handle, and we will learn how in a minute. And these affine mappings are used for the modeling transformation, so to map from object space to world space, and for this camera mapping that transforms from world space to a space that is local to the current camera. These are affine mappings. Yeah? And this last one, this step here, is not affine anymore. And we will also learn about the difference. Okay, so affine transformations, maybe they can best be described by the typical cases that they can represent. So the typical affine transformations are translations, rotations, scalings, and sharings. And in fact, every affine transformation is a sequence of these operations here. Yeah? So they span the entire space of affine transformations. And so we will see these in a minute. And from affine transformations, the rather big class, there are a number of subclasses that we will also look into. These are rigid transformations, similarity transformations, and linear transformations. We will look at these differences right now. So the first important class are rigid transformations. And rigid transformation simply means I take an object, I move it, I translate it, and I rotate it. Yeah? And this transformation obviously is rigid, because I can do that with any rigid, with any stiff object. I do not need to deform the object anyhow. Yeah? And of course, this is the typical transformation that you use to position an object somewhere in space. Yeah? You put it at a certain place and rotate it to the orientation that you want to have. That's what we call rigid. Rigid transformations preserve distances. Yeah? So, the length of this table won't change under a rigid transformation. It also preserves angles. So all the angles in the table remain. Yeah, no changes here happen. And of course, it's a very interesting and important subclass. And if we look at that now in this setup of our coordinate frame here, it's quite simple to see what a rigid transformation, what properties it will have. If we look at that coordinate frame, a transformation will be rigid if these two coordinate axes, E1 and E2, remain perpendicular. Here in this case, they are not. Yeah, that's why this shape here is a bit deformed. And the length of these should remain 1. Yeah? So scaling, inflating like a balloon is not rigid. So also the length of these axes should remain. So this can easily be described. Yeah? So if we look at this transformation here, then rigid transformation just means that the columns of A are orthogonal and that they have unit length. Yeah? So if we have a matrix, and the question is, is this now a rigid transformation? Then that's quite simple. Any translation is possible, so these values we don't have to look at. And for these two, we just have to look whether these are two vectors that are orthogonal. That means their scalar product is 0, and whether they have unit length. If this is the case, then we have a rotation. But we have to take care in one thing still. This is this case here. This is a simple reflection. And now we could discuss, such a reflection, is this rigid? And the interpretation is no, it's not rigid. And in particular, if I take your left hand, I'm not able to generate a right hand from it without using any force. Yeah? So making your left hand a right hand is not rigid. It's not something you want me to do with you. So such a reflection is not rigid, but nevertheless, the two unit vectors after this operation are perpendicular and they have length 1. Yeah? But one thing is that their orientation changes, and the orientation of these axes can be tested using the determinant. So as an additional condition, we have to apply that the determinant is positive. So if it's negative, then we have a reflection. If it's positive, then we are fine. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's rigid transformations, and now a larger class containing the rigid transformations is isotropic scaling. So that means we allow any rotations, any translations, like with rigid, but we also allow uniform scaling. So inflating an object is allowed. So that means objects can change their size, but they remain similar. Similar means that length is not preserved, but all ratios are preserved. So taking this table here and inflating it to twice the size means that both, the height, the length, and the depth of the table are all scaled by a factor of 2. Just inflating in height is not allowed. And essentially, this such a typical similarity operation is just converting from inches to centimeter, or from foot to meters. That's a uniform scaling. So it changes distances, but it still preserves angles. And preserving angles means we have to scale in all axes by the same value. Otherwise, angles are not preserved. So examples are dilation or contraction, just inflating an object or doing the opposite, contracting an object. Reflection is also an example, or this now counts also as a similarity transformation if we say that it preserves ratios of distances, then reflection is also a similarity transformation. Rotation and translation, of course, they are also rigid. And a similarity transformation now can be simply described as by such a system here. A again is an orthogonal matrix, like for the rotation, and then additionally we have a scaling factor. Yeah, it's rigid plus a scaling factor, or times a scaling factor. More precisely. Good. And then we have another class, and these are linear operations. Now, linear operations are essentially operations, affine operations with a zero translation. So, this mapping x to ax, this is linear. There's no translation involved. That means that the origin is always mapped to the origin. But otherwise, everything is allowed. You see here the examples. The origin always remains the origin. But we can now do scaling, non-uniform scaling. We can do reflections, and we can do sharings. So obviously, angles are not preserved. And you see that they intersect here with these previous transformations in the sense that identity and rotation are linear, but additionally there are new ones, non-uniform scaling, reflection. Oh, reflection was in the similarities here, right? Okay, didn't take care of that. So I would say that this belongs to here. but sharing definitely is not a similarity operation. Linear transformations are described by this here. And it's just a multiplication with an arbitrary matrix. Scaling, sharing, and rotation belong to these. Scaling, non-uniform scaling, simply, if we look at that matrix, looks like this. We have the scaling factor in x direction here and the one in y direction here. So we only have values on the diagonal. And so we simply, if we apply this matrix to a point, obviously we get this scaling here. Yeah, and this changes length and possibly and direction. That also means it changes angles. Yeah, if we have non-uniform scaling. Examples, uniform scaling. This square here becomes a smaller square, but if we have non-uniform scaling, it becomes thinner but higher in that example. Yeah? And if we look at the diagonal, for instance, we see the angle of the diagonal here is 45 degrees, and here it's obviously no longer 45 degrees, so angles are not preserved. In 3D, obviously, the matrix is almost the same, but we have a third scaling factor. Okay, sharing now is an interesting operation because it's the main difference between similarity operations and affine operations, and sharing simply means that our new axes E1 and E2 do no longer need to be perpendicular. Yeah? So we can have any angle here. And this results in sharing. For sharing, we can use certain subcases. The typical one is a sharing in x direction. That means such a square, if it's shared in x direction, becomes this parallelogram. And if we share it in y direction, then it becomes this one. Yeah? And these are the corresponding matrices. And S is a value that just describes how strong the sharing is. And if we look at these examples here, we can easily see that. And in fact, if I look at that, I think that value is too much. Or 45 degrees, that's not 45 degrees, right? Okay, now it looks like I do not look at these slides before I give the lecture, but in fact I do. But when explaining things, you think about several things more than if you just look at the slides. Okay, so that should be a 45 degree angle, which in this image it is not. Yeah, because essentially, again, you can say here, these two vectors are this. So this is this vector, and this should be this vector here. But obviously the slope is wrong here. Okay, so sorry for that. And for the vertical, it's the same. Now the x-axis is mapped to this vector, so that should have a 45 degree slope here. And this is this vector, so this remains unchanged. Okay, then another linear transformation is rotation. So we already spoke about that, but now it's maybe a good time to have a little bit of closer look at that, and we will start with a much simpler case of rotation in 2D. In 2D, a rotation can simply be described by an angle. Yeah? So since we're now in the class of linear transformation, we only look at rotations around the origin. The origin is always mapped to the origin. Yeah? So we have to rotate around the origin. And then the only degree of freedom that we have is any angle alpha. And now we can think about how we can describe such a rotation by an angle alpha. One possibility would be that we take any vector alpha, any vector A, transform that into polar coordinates. That means we describe that point using an angle and a length. Yeah. So in that case, A would be described by the angle alpha and this length here. And now we apply a rotation, so we rotate by phi. Yeah, sorry, I first said alpha, but in fact we want to rotate by phi. So that gives us a new point B, and B has exactly the same length as A in polar coordinates, but the angle is just alpha plus phi. Yeah? So in polar coordinates, such a rotation is trivial. We just have to add phi to the angle. So if we put all this together and we apply one of the theorems on trigonometry that says that the cosine of alpha plus beta can be expressed this way, we get this expression here. Oh, sorry, there's... okay, I changed about 700s of these this morning. Yeah, so maybe another one slipped through. Okay, so that's phi here. Yeah, we get these formulas here. Yeah, for bx and by. And now here, r cosine alpha, this is exactly ax. This is ay here. This is minus ay, or also ay, and this is ax. So these are the original coordinates. Yeah? And you see, rotation means multiplying by these cosine and sine values, and we can transform these to a matrix. Yeah? So we have this, and we can write this as a matrix, then we get this matrix. That's this cosine minus sine, this. Okay. That's right, because here this is ax, yeah, so that's this sine and this cosine. Okay, yeah, I'm sure you already saw this matrix, and there are probably also very other ways to interpret this. And here again you can see the rotated unit vectors. Yeah, that's just the unit vector in direction phi, and that's the unit vector in direction phi plus 90 degrees. Okay, and yeah, it's also clear what these rotations do. Yeah, rotating by 45 degrees results in this matrix. And counterclockwise is typically the interpretation of positive rotation angle. And this is the negative orientation angle. We get this. And rotation is always around the origin as long as we are linear. OK. So much for now on rotations. Then reflection, I mean, that's almost trivial. Reflection just means changing the sign of one of the coordinates, typically. So multiplying y by minus 1 results in this here. So that's the corresponding matrix. And yeah, reflection at the y-axis is this matrix here. And now, yeah, this also shows us, if we just look at the unit vectors, we still have, this is a unit vector, this is a unit vector, they are both orthogonal, but it's not a rotation because the determinant of that one is minus 1. Yeah? So that's a counterexample for a reflection that has an orthogonal matrix. Yeah, so the determinant of a reflection is negative. And yeah, in 3D, the same, essentially the same reflections are possible, but there's just one more that we can reflect with. Okay, yeah, so with linear operations, we can describe rotations, we can make sharings, scalings, we can do reflections, and as I, and yeah, every linear transformation can be described as a composition of all of these. Yeah, so we can, for instance, say we first do a rotation, then a scaling, and then a sharing, and this describes us every possible transformation. And the nice thing now, if we describe all these transformations using matrices, the composition of these transformations can simply be described by a matrix multiplication. So if we map, or if we have one transformation that is described by a matrix S, and then we have another one which is described by a matrix R, we can simply replace this V2 by this here, and this gives us this expression here. And now this is associative, so we can also put the braces like this, and this means we can simply multiply together R and S. important is the, or what is a typical mistake that is made, is that in our the way we describe the application of matrices to vectors, we always multiply vectors from the right. Yeah, so we multiply this vector to this matrix, and that means in this case here that first S is applied and then R. Yeah, so the order in which the transformations are applied in this matrix is from right to left. So if you first want to do apply a matrix A and then B, you have to use BA. Yeah, that's a bit counterintuitive. And in fact, if you look to older textbooks or probably also newer ones from other areas, they do not use this convention. Instead, they multiply a vector to a matrix. So they multiply the vector as a row vector to such a matrix. Yeah, and then you always have to think in a transposed way. Now, these are the transformed unit vectors and stuff like that. But then the order is the other way around. Yeah? Then you can really read these from left to right. Both have advantages and disadvantages. So this is the notion or the way that is used in computer graphics almost everywhere. Okay, good. Yeah, so instead of, so that means what we can do, if we have this square here, for instance, and now we first do a scaling and then we rotate, the resulting matrix that directly does both these two steps can be achieved by multiplying together these two matrices. This time this, and this gives this matrix. And this also makes clear that we have to be careful with the order. So first applying this transformation and this transformation delivers a different result from first rotating and then doing the uniform scaling. Yeah, that's something different. Matrix multiplication is not commutative. So A times B is not equal to B times A. Yeah? For matrices. Okay. And you can think about such a scaling, then rotating example by yourself. Just draw it, and you will see the difference. So that's this one. Okay. We can also put it the other way around, and I want to show an interesting example for that. We can say that, for instance, every linear transformation, every arbitrary linear transformation can be mapped to a product or to a composition, for instance, of a scaling, a rotation, and a sharing. Yeah, and so one interesting thing is that any 2D transformation can be decomposed into such a product, first rotate, for instance, first rotate, then scale, and then rotate again. Yeah. So if you look at that, you might realize that this is nothing but Singulärwertzerlegung, singular value decomposition. So that's just a different interpretation from a more geometric computer graphics point of view. And here one example, so any sharing, that's maybe the surprising part, can I really get from here to here by only applying rotations and non-uniform scalings? But it works, so we can first do this rotation, for instance, and then we do this non-uniform scaling, and you see this non-uniform scaling now, it only reduces or shrinks in height. And at that operation, the sharing happens. You don't see it that well here, but if we rotate it back, you see now that this object has been shared. Yeah? So that's one interesting thing. And another one, which is from a practical point of view quite interesting, is the following. And that's every rotation. Yeah, you know these matrix. This is the matrix that describes rotation. Every rotation can be described by a composition of three sharings. Yeah, all of these are obviously sharings. Yeah, you see, you always have ones here. And this was the parameter that we described as S. So it's all of these three are the standard sharings in x and y direction. And now it can be shown that every rotation can be described by three such sharings. And now you might say, OK, so why should that help us? It can help us because it's a very efficient way to rotate images. Yeah? And if you imagine, rotating an image is an interesting problem. Yeah? Let's assume you have an image that, for instance, is a character. And like this, so you have the character A and you want to rotate it and have this version here on the screen, then yeah, it's not immediately clear how to do that. Yeah? You might take every pixel of that image and apply the rotation, and this gives you new pixel positions. Yeah, and you said then copy the color from this pixel to this pixel, but with this you will see that there are holes here in this image. There will be holes in here. Yeah, pixels that are not hit. Some are hit twice and others are not hidden, not hit. So that's not a good option. The better option is that you do the scanline algorithm here. And for each of these pixels, you go back and you copy the color value from here to here. But now exactly the same problem can happen. If you have a very thin line, for instance, here, that is only one pixel wide, it can happen that some of these pixels are not hit. And as a result, you get a broken line here. Yeah? So that's also not so nice option. And a nice thing here now is that obviously we can do this rotation from here to here by only doing sharings. And doing a sharing is quite simple. Because let's look at this checkerboard here. Yeah? Applying a sharing to that checkerboard just means that we take single lines of this picture and just shift them to the right or to the left. Yeah? And how much we have to shift them depends on the line. So here, let's say this is fixed. So this and this, is there's no offset in between. And the second line now is shifted to the right one pixel. The third line, again one pixel. Then the next line is shifted to the right by two pixels and so forth. Yeah? So that's essentially the Brasenheim algorithm that you learned to compute how far we have to shift. And now from this image, we again get a perfect image where every pixel from here also appears here. No pixels get lost. Yeah? Nothing is hit twice or whatever. Yeah? Exactly every pixel from here also is mapped to here. And then we can continue that in this direction, now in y direction, and again one in x direction, and we get this rotated image here. And now every pixel from here, or every pixel here, is mapped exactly to one pixel here. And we only have used very, very fast, or rather fast operations, just shifting single lines or columns. Okay, so that's quite useful. And there are applications for that. So one quite old application, but still often used application is volume rendering. So we won't get that far here in this lecture. But maybe you know these CT images. X-ray images. where many X-ray images are taken, and then you get slices through the body, for instance, or through the, through a head. You get multiple of these images, and you want now want to view them three-dimensionally. You want to reconstruct the three-dimensional structure by just taking all these sliced images and putting them on top of each other. And now you want to look at these sliced stack from arbitrary directions. And if you now look at this stack from some arbitrary direction, what you exactly need is that you render each of these slices to your screen. And all each of these slices now have to be rotated in such a way and then blend together. And this is quite costly. And there is, of course, doctors need that operation. I mean, today it's no problem. A standard PC can do that, standard PC. But there are special boards that can do that. And they heavily rely on these operations because these are very simple operations and all the necessary rotations can be done using that very efficiently. And in particular, no pixels get lost, which is very important for doctors. Of course, they want to avoid that single pixels get lost or something, or structures get bigger than they were in the original image. And I think that's understandable. Okay, good. Yeah. So here again, the description. Each of these operations here can be simply described by such a simple movement of single lines, which is very, very simple. Okay, good. Yeah, so that's rotations in 2D. And now rotations in 3D. So up to now, these images that we had were always 2D, and for sharing and scaling and so on, I always said, okay, for 3D, it's exactly the same. Yeah, it's just the matrix is a little bit bigger. But rotation is a very interesting subcase. Rotations in 3D are quite complicated. They are much more complicated than rotations in 2D. And you will see, probably not today, but probably on Thursday then, why this is the case. And this is why we will handle rotations in 3D in an extra subchapter where we look at this special important case, and particularly important rotations in 3D are for computer graphics, where objects really need to be positioned in space at an arbitrary rotation. And then it's very important to describe these rotations in a useful manner. Okay, good. So another remark I described in the beginning, the difference that we see between points and vectors. And so it might also make sense to look at this now. And up to now, these affine transformations that we were looking at were always transformations on points. Yeah, so I said, okay, this point is transformed to this point. And looking at vectors, we will see that there is a difference. So if we look at this shape again, this heart here, and we take these two points, and we call them A and B, and we look at the vector from A to B, we will see that after the transformation, this vector becomes this vector. And now, obviously, if we look at the formulas, and we take we apply an affine transformation to B and an affine transformation to A, we will see that this T here cancels out, and what remains is that the vector here is only transformed by the matrix, and of course not by the translation. That makes sense, If I take this heart here and move it further to the right, I do not expect this vector to change. That would be weird. That's a subtlety, but you will see in maybe also in the programming examples that it makes absolute sense to take care of that. If you take a direction, for instance, the direction to the light source, and you apply a transformation to the object, you should take care that for the vector here, you do not apply the translation. That doesn't make sense. And a particular annoying example are normal vectors. Now, why is this even more tricky? Yeah? For normal vectors, it's not enough just to ignore the translation, but we have to be even more careful. So look at this example. This is a rectangle, obviously. And now we look at this face here, and this face has a normal, and it has a tangent vector. Yeah? Okay, let's assume for now they are both normalized, so they both have unit length. Okay, now if we do a sharing on that, yeah, and we apply now only the matrix, not the translation, we apply the matrix to n and t, to these two vectors, the new normal will be this one. Yeah? But obviously that's not the normal. Yeah? So this is not the normal of this face. The direction of this face, the orientation of this face has not changed under the sharing. Yeah? But the normal, here this transformed normal, or if we do the transformation wrong, or simply apply A to our normal, we get the wrong result. Yeah? So for the normal, obviously this trick does not work, or just multiplying the matrix, but for the tangent it does. Yeah, this can quickly be seen looking at a few examples. The tangent vector remains a tangent vector, yeah, if we only apply the matrix A. Yeah, so this is matrix A times M. It's not N and it's not at. Yeah, it's a formula, AN. Okay. Yeah, so normals are obviously a bit different. Yeah, this is not a simple vector that we can just apply our matrix to. Yeah, it's different. And with writing things down in the right way, it can quickly be determined how we have to transform normal vectors. And the idea is the following. So if we go back again, sorry, a normal vector has the property that it's perpendicular to the tangent vector. Yeah, normal vector and tangent vector should be perpendicular. Obviously, this is here no longer the case, but we said that the tangent vector is transformed correctly, so our new normal vector should be perpendicular to the tangent vector. Yeah, so in 2D, that's enough to define the new normal, but this formula that we derive here will also be correct in 3D. So what we can do, yeah, so our original normal, n, is perpendicular to the tangent vector. Now let's assume we apply our matrix A to t. This gives us the new tangent, t prime. Yeah? That's this tangent vector here, yeah, unchanged in this example. So this is t prime. Now let's start with this expression, nt, scalar product with t. Now we add identity matrix here in between. That changes nothing. It's just an identity. We replace this identity with A inverse times A. Yeah, that's also the identity. And then we add new braces. And we see this AT here, this is the transformed normal, transformed tangent vector. So this is t prime. And this here in front, now obviously this is a new transformed normal that is again perpendicular to the transformed tangent. I'm just so sorry, this slipped up here a bit. So there's nothing special. Yeah, it's just should be a bit further down. So obviously this here is now a transformed normal that is perpendicular to the transformed tangent. Yeah? So this here is exactly this vector we are looking for. Oops. Yeah. So our new n prime should be, yeah, this vector, but we have to take the transpose of this one. Yeah, because this is just the scalar product written as a matrix product. So this is the transposed version of our normal we are looking for. So n prime should be this one transposed. And if we distribute the transposition in here, then here an n is missing. So here an n on the right. Yeah. So that means changing the order of these terms, and we end up with this formula here. Yeah. So that means we have to transform our normal with this expression here. Yeah. So this is the transposed of the inverse. Okay. So that means normal vectors need to be transformed by this matrix here. Yeah. And you will see that if you look at I already told you about these shading languages, and you will or have seen them in the programming exercises. And then there are several of these matrices available that you can or have to use to transform your objects. And there's always a special matrix for transforming normals. And in fact, now you know why there is a special normal matrix. It's exactly this reason here. And but often we don't have to care about that, because you probably know that if our matrix, or if A is an orthogonal matrix, that means if it describes a Richter transformation, then the transposition of that matrix is the inverse. Yeah. Then A inverse, inverting that matrix, simply means computing the transposition. And if we do this transposition again, yeah, then the matrix is the same. That means as long as we only have Richter transformations, or it can even be, if we don't care about scaling, then we can also allow similarity, then the normals can simply be transformed like normal vectors. But as soon as we have a sharing component in it, we have to take care of that. And another thing, this transposed normal here, this transformed normal, will not have unit length anymore. Yeah. So after this transformation, these normals always have to be renormalized again. If you want to use them for lighting computations, for instance, yeah, they need to be normalized again. Okay. Good. So this was kind of introduction, the different types of affine transformations that we have. And we can also, so we always looked at these transformations in this way, how it is described by multiplying with a matrix and adding a translation. There are other more abstract ways to describe affine mappings. And one of this is here, so we can characterize affine mappings with the following properties. So the first one, an affine mapping should map lines to lines. So that's a very important property. But we will see that this is also a property of projective transformations. But okay, so that's an important thing. Then the next one, parallel lines will be mapped to parallel lines. So parallel lines remain parallel. That's a very important difference to projective mappings. And perspective, yeah, is a projective mapping. Or put it the other way around, with this property, we can easily see that perspective is not an affine mapping. The typical example is rails of a railway. Yeah, you know this image. Yeah? So that's a railway. And obviously these rails are parallel in the world, but in the image they are not. Yeah? So that's why this perspective obviously is not affine. Okay. Yeah, so we will have to leave the class of affine mappings if we want to get something like perspective. Another property that is also important for affine mappings is that division ratios are maintained. I will show that on the next slide. What is not preserved are angles. And So let's, if we look at these examples, for instance, if we have parallel lines which are mapped to parallel again, then, I mean, it doesn't automatically mean that it's affine, but if it's affine, then parallel are mapped to parallel, and it's not affine if they are mapped to something like this. If we have a line, and we, for instance, take the midpoint of that line, and we map these three points, yeah? Oh, let's first make this example. Then the third point must be on the line again, otherwise a line would not be mapped to a line. And the point must be the midpoint again. It must be within these two, it must remain at this position. Yeah? If we have a situation like this, yeah, which where this point that was further that was previously the midpoint now is somewhere here outside of the center, then this is again not affine. Yeah? Okay. Good. So now we have affine mappings. I hope I could show you that they describe an important class of transformations, and there are already quite a few things that we can do with them. But now one might say, okay, there's still a little bit this property that this representation is not very elegant, yeah, because we have now this matrix and a vector, and this is not a very, yeah, there's always a distinction between these two. If we apply a vector, for instance, we only have to apply A but not B. That's also a bit, yeah, weird and strange. And in fact, there's a very nice way to unify all this, and it's also a way that will open us the door for projective transformations. And these are homogeneous coordinates. Many of you have heard about this. So the easy way to describe homogeneous coordinates is to say, okay, we take a point in 2D and we add a further dimension. So we add an additional coordinate. So if we are in 2D, we add a third coordinate, or if we're in 3D, we add a fourth coordinate. And for the beginning, we will set this to 1. Yeah? Okay. And if we've done so, now we can apply a 3x3 or a 4x4 matrix. Yeah? So we can now do a linear mapping using this additional coordinate. So by this way, now we have a larger matrix. Yeah? And we can add more features in there. But in the end, of course, I do not want to have, if I map a 2D point, I want to end in 2D again. So we have to get also rid of that third coordinate, and we simply get rid of this third coordinate by dividing through this additional coordinate. So in some sense, one could also interpret this fourth or this additional coordinate as a common denominator for all of these. Yeah? And by setting this to 1 in the beginning, yeah, we change nothing. Yeah? These points are divided by 1, so nothing changes. But after this mapping, this value can be different, and it will be a common denominator for all of these. Yeah? So all these coordinates are divided by this additional coordinate. And then we are back at 2D again. Okay, so that's the kind of simple description. A bit more sophisticated description would be that we identify every point x, y with a line going through the origin in a space with one dimension more. So a point x, y, yeah, a 2D point x, y is interpreted as this line here in 3D. Yeah, alpha is a parameter going from whatever arbitrary value in R. And now we identify our point in 2D with that three-dimensional line. Okay, we will see later on how what we can do with this interpretation. Essentially, that means that all of these points here, x, y, 1, but also 3x, 3y, 3, and this one, they are all points on this line here, yeah, and they all represent the same 2D point. Yeah, it's just, yeah, we map this point now to a complete line. Okay, good, but now let's come back. So how does that look more precisely again? Now let's say we have a 3D point XYZ, we add this fourth coordinate XYZ1, then we apply a matrix A, and this matrix is a 4x4 matrix. Yeah? And this gives us new coordinates, x prime, y prime, z prime, w prime, and then we divide all these by w prime, and this gives us a 3D point again. And if we take the entries of A, yeah, that means that the resulting point looks like this. So this is the first row of A, and because there's a 1 here in the end, yeah, we get here this addition. We will see that later on more precisely in these matrices. And here again, we have a linear combination of x, y, and z plus this offset here. And here again, we have a linear combination plus this here. And if you look at this a bit closer, you might realize that this is exactly what we described as an affine mapping. Yeah? This here is multiplying with a matrix, but just with the upper left 3x3 matrix, and this is simply an addition of a translation. Yeah. But furthermore, we also have now this division here. This is the division by W prime. Yeah. So this is this common denominator. Okay, and if we now assume that, okay, I will continue with that here. If we now assume that our matrix looks like this, that means we have, okay, now this is the 2x2 example again. Let me go back to this formula here. So this part here, yeah, is essentially this matrix A11 to A33, A31, A13. So we take this submatrix. So here we have one further column, one further row, and one further column. But this part here is taking this matrix, yeah, times x, y, z, plus this vector here, yeah, plus t. So that's essentially what we described as an affine mapping, yeah, where this is the matrix and this is the translation. And if we now assume that here this last row is 0, 0, 0, 1, what will happen is that W prime will always be 1 again. Yeah? So by applying or by multiplying x, y, z, 1 to this matrix, yeah, the new W1 will be 0 times x plus 0 times y plus 0 times z plus 1. Yeah? So the new vector here will always have a 1 here again. So this denominator is 1, and we can simply skip it, and the result is that we get this mapping. And this now is exactly an affine mapping. Yeah? This is the matrix, and this is the translation. So if we look at the matrix here, we have here the linear part of the affine mapping. Here we have the translation. And for the lower column, we assume that it's 0, 0, 0, 1 or 0, 0, 1 for a 2D mapping. Okay, so that means if we have homogeneous coordinates, yeah, our affine mapping becomes a linear mapping using these homogeneous coordinates, or essentially this here. Yeah? Now, if we have these homogeneous coordinates, we can generate a translation by multiplying with a matrix. That's a bit weird, but it works. Yeah? We can get a translation by multiplying with that matrix. So yeah, that's a very nice way to kind of unify that. We say instead of multiplying with a matrix and adding a translation, we all pack it into a single matrix and say it's just a matrix multiplication. The price is that we first have to add this additional component, and in the end we have to get rid of that additional component again. But in between all transformations, we can compute by 4x4 matrices. Yeah, and that's very convenient. Because now, another example where this could help, yeah, maybe I should add that as a motivation. If you look at the at the composition of affine transformations, yeah, so you have one mapping x to ax plus t, or let's say a1x plus t1, and then you have an additional mapping a2x plus t2, and you want to apply these transformations one after the other. Yeah, so you have to do that. So first you apply this one. And then this result is applied here. Then you get this. And now you want to compute, I mean, that's again affine. Yeah? The composition of affine transformations is always an affine transformation. But to compute now the matrices and so on for this new complete composited transformation, you get this here plus t1 plus t2. Yeah? So that's the new a, and that's the new t. Yeah? And that's a bit, yeah, it's not very elegant, in particular that part here. Using this representation here, such a matrix, yeah, we can simply take the two matrices and multiply them together. I mean, it's computational-wise, it's exactly the same that is computed here, but just writing it down is much more elegant. Okay. Yeah, so the nice thing, yeah, as I said, is that using this representation, we can do the composition by just multiplying together matrices. That means if we have the mapping from x to tx and from y to sy, so we have a mapping with matrix T and a mapping with matrix S, we can just compute the composition by just multiplying together these matrices. That's what we already said before. And, oops, okay. And another interesting thing that works here is that inversion, that means undoing a transformation, is simply represented by computing the inverse of a matrix. And that's also how something that we know, or I hope we know how to do that. And that's by calling the inverse function of your math library. Okay, good. Yeah, so mapping all this to matrices, to matrix multiplication is convenient. We can do compositions, we can compute with it, we can compute inversions and stuff like that. Okay, so let's look at the basic 3D transformations that we had up to now. And again, these are all affine transformations. So for now, we always assume that we have 0, 0, 0, 1 down here. Yeah. The other advantage of this representation is that we will see by releasing this constraint on the last row here, we get a new class of transformations, and these will be the projective ones. So if we allow arbitrary entries down here, then we can describe even the perspective projection and stuff like that. Yeah? So we will be able to describe the entire way from an object point in object coordinates to the screen, this entire way, as a product of multiple matrices. Yeah? All these steps of the pipeline or all these coordinate transformations can be described by 4x4 matrices, and by multiplying all these together, we have one matrix that maps from one coordinate system to screen space. Yeah? And that's very convenient. But first of all, let's look at the very simple basic cases. So a translation now looks like this. Yeah, it's the unit matrix or identity matrix, and the translation vectors are here. Scaling looks like this. Yeah, so this upper 3x3 part we knew, we already had. Now the matrix is just a bit bigger. Sharing looks like this. So this is a sharing in Z direction, and for the other ones, it's equivalent. Okay, also rotations can be described with these matrices, of course. Now in three dimensions, we have to, first of all, okay, so in 2D, it was very simple. In 2D, we only had a rotation, yeah. okay, we couldn't decide about the axis around which we rotate, yeah. In 3D, we can rotate around different axes. Yeah? If I take this presenter, I can rotate this way, but I can also rotate this way or rotate this way. Yeah? Or take an arbitrary rotation axis. In 2D, I don't have these possibilities. Yeah? I can only rotate in my plane. Okay, so the rotations around the main axis are shown here. So this is essentially just looking at the projection to one of the main planes, XY plane, YZ plane, XZ plane, and doing the rotation in there. Yeah, so these cosine and sine terms you know from the 2D derivations, and yeah, that's just transformed to different parameters of the rotation. For when we looked at the rotations, I said, or we looked at the rotations as a linear transformation. And as I said, linear means the origin is mapped to the origin, so we can only rotate around the origin. Now, if we want to have an arbitrary rotation around an arbitrary center point, yeah, now we have a very convenient way to describe that, because we first say we translate by minus c. Yeah, so we translate the rotation center to the origin, then we perform our rotation, and then we translate back. In 2D, this would look like this. So we have this homogeneous matrix. It's 3x3 because we are in 2D, yeah, but it's a homogeneous matrix. So that's, we have to read from right to left, yeah, as I told you. So we first do this. So this is a translation by minus the center, okay, at one place I changed it, but here it got lost. Sorry. So that should be Cx and this Cy. Strange. Okay. So we translate by this. Then we do the rotation, and then we translate back. Yeah, so that means if we want to rotate around this point, what we do is that this object, for instance, we first translate this object to here. Then we rotate. Yeah, and then we translate it back. And then we have this here. Yeah, and all this together, if we just multiply that together, we get one matrix, yeah, that does this rotation around an arbitrary center. Okay, good. So in this context, let me add a final short remark, which is I think rather simple, but it's a typical thing where one has to take care and be aware of the difference, and that's when we interpret these matrices and so on. You will end up sitting in the programming exercises, for instance, and they say, okay, so that's my world coordinate system. Now I do a rotation around Z, then I do a rotation around X, then I translate in Y direction, and you try to imagine what happens if you do it in the right order. And if you do so, you always have to take care that there are different ways to interpret these. And you always have to think in two different coordinate systems, the local coordinate system or the global coordinate system. An interpretation would be the following. So let's assume you have this simple scene. So that's your coordinate, your world coordinate system, and you have a car here, and this car drives to the right. So you might say, okay, what I do is that I apply to this point, I apply a transformation so that it ends up here. Yeah, it drives 2 units to the left. An alternative interpretation would be, okay, the car is fixed, but I move the world towards the car. Yeah? In fact, that doesn't make a difference. And you know that since Einstein, this is exactly the same. Yeah? It's not distinguishable. In your thinking in coordinate systems, this means we have to differentiate a global coordinate system and a local one. And if I say, okay, I first rotate around Z, and then I move in Y direction, and so on, I always think in my local coordinate system. So that means if I do a rotation now, I rotate around my local Z coordinate. No, that's X. Yeah? Around my local X coordinate. If I do a rotation around the global X coordinate, it would be that rotation. That's a different one. But if you prefer to always think in the global context, yeah, then you will get a different result. So maybe that sounds confusing for now, but I'm pretty sure you will experience that. And then maybe you will remember, okay, there was this difference and I have to think about that, and now I understand what he meant. And that's maybe not the perfect last sentence for a lecture, but time's up now, and I will stop for now. And we will continue with transforming these coordinate systems and so on Thursday, again at 12:30. Thank you.